From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. When you need to know the truth, keep it on the Damian Richardson Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to the show on Thursday, the 23rd of March, as the fallout from the turf war, the trans-exclusionary radical feminists speaking up for women-only spaces against the trans movement. There's been no further sight, of course, of the Nazis. They only made their presence felt in Melbourne, Victoria, because, well, what a surprise. There'd be such a response to Daniel Andrews as that he would create a group of people that felt it was important to come onto the street and do the Nazi salute. Although we'll talk about that in a minute. Well, hopefully we will. But first, I want to talk about this fallout from the turf wars is having a personal effect on me. So my 18-year-old daughter got home last night from work, and I had a chat with her. I said, gee, what's going on with this turf stuff? You know, it was pretty tough day on the radio talking to people about it and stuff. And she said, yes, Dad, it's terrible. I can't believe that these men are allowed to go into our spaces, you know, and it's frightening. I don't feel safe in the toilet and stuff. And I said, no, that's terrible, darling. I said, it's really, really, really bad, you know, and it's terrible these men can identify as women now, if they want, self-identify, and, you know, that's because of, you know, feminism. And she said, no, Dad, it's because of the patriarchy. They're men coming into women's spaces, and that's the patriarchy. And I said, well, that's really strange, love, because I've got to be honest with you, when I went to uni, I know you don't know, but back in the 80s, your dad was still, he was alive, and he was your age, and I went to uni, and they basically said to me, no, the patriarchy was there was too much order, there's too much control being imposed by men, so people weren't free to express themselves as they might want to be. You know, women were stuck being, you know, behind a stovetop and working, and man was the patriarchal head of the house. He'd come home from work and expect to be waited on, that sort of stuff. It was too rigid. And she said, no, that's not the patriarchy. The patriarchy is not that anymore. The patriarchy is men identifying as women coming into our spaces. And I said, well, no, love, that's changed. I said, look, doesn't matter. You're too young to understand. She said, no, Dad, no, you're too old to understand how it's happening now. And I thought, oh, my God, you're spending too much time with your mother. What do you do? Do you capitulate? I said, well, look, love, that's not how I saw it. This is literally, I think, this is basically feminism is now having its identity politics babies, and it can't control them, and it wants the men to come back in and be part of the patriarchy. And she said, well, even if that's the case, Dad, even if that is the case, it's your fault. It's the patriarchy's fault for letting women have feminism in the first place. I thought, this girl's brilliant. Brilliant, outmaneuvered again, like I always was at uni, because feminism just moves and goes wherever it wants to. And now my daughter's a product of that as well. And she's got a fire in her belly. I've got no idea, of course, where she gets that from. So it's even come into my home. The turf wars have come into my home. And of course, I still made her dinner and still made her lunch to take to work today. But anyway, that just didn't factor into the 18-year-old's equation. But, you know, I'm happy now. I've decided, after I've seen what's happened in Sydney a couple of days ago, and Mark Latham tried to speak at an event in Belfield in Sydney's West. He was invited to speak at a church. And of course, the turf warriors turned up. The trans warriors indeed. Sorry, I'm getting confused. The trans warriors turned up. The trans fascists, as I've heard them described as. The rainbow fascists turned up, tried to shut down this meeting. And now the Christians turn up, and apparently there's a bit of a fair bit of altercation going on, of course, that the media found on the side of the trans community, that the Christians were at fault. And that might explain why there's just a huge drop in people actually voting in Sydney's West. Apparently there's like a 20% donkey vote, which must cause the good burgers some concern. They'd know there's a significant number of people feeling disenfranchised, people from traditional communities, no doubt. Traditional communities that might want to ally with someone like me. And we saw it again in Canberra today. Of course, Lydia Thorpe was having some sort of attention deprivation, so she thought she'd make herself at the centre of attention. And it's sort of a case of, you know, I'll support your victim narrative if you support mine. And that's what she did. And now she's complaining, of course, about police brutality, because you can imagine some Canberra cops saying, Liz, look, there's an Aboriginal senator there. Let's really lay hard into her, like, you know, like we do when we come across Aboriginal people, because that's what we always hear, of course, in the media. And they thought, we'll give Thorpe a real taste of this, because that wouldn't come back to bite them, would they? No one would say anything about that. They just say, oh, business as usual, nothing to see here. And so I've decided I don't care about Moira Deeming staying in the Liberal Party in Victoria. I hope John Pesutto, the cowardly Liberal leader, gets his way and gets rid of her. I want her gone because I want the whole thing to collapse. I don't want it to be held together with little bits of wire and cellophane and tape. Oh, so, you know, oh, look, there's still a really strong, committed Conservative Party with no conservative values. We're going to out-left the left if we can, but, God, we're going to be much better on economic policy. Don't you believe it? Don't you just trust it? Well, no, I don't trust it at all. So I want the whole thing to capitulate, the whole stinking thing to capitulate so we can start again. You know, maybe we can start again with Moira as a leader. I don't mind. Good on her. Moira, you can be the leader. And there'd probably be a few others that could follow you. I'm sure, you know, Bernie Finn sat in that chair that you're sitting in the Western District before you, the poison chalice of the Western District for the Liberals, as they try and save their, you know, eastern inner city seats and don't care about what's happening anywhere else or particularly out in the suburbs like, Kilsyth or even further out, go out into the regions like Wonthaggi or whatever. Do the Liberals care about those people? No, they just care about that inner city clique. So I want the whole thing to just fall down in a heap. But this is the problem. This is the problem. There is rumours that there is an allegiance, an alliance starting of disaffected, well, they're not even conservative groups. I've been cast as a conservative and I wouldn't even call myself one. I felt like I'm just normal. I'm normal. Can we have some just normal people representation where, you know, when a man says a woman can have a vagina, you don't even answer him because, you know, it's insane. It's certifiable. It's certifiable. But what would we call this party? That's what I'm asking people. I'm asking people to get on our TNT website, hit up my email address, which you can find on the TNT website, and tell us what is the name of this conservative rump or this common sense rump. I don't even see, I keep getting stuck in the language that the left give us. No, just common sense, the party of common sense. Maybe that's what it should be. I know my mum said one time we should call a party fed up. Imagine how many people would go and vote for that party if they just saw it on the ballot. Fed up, absolutely fed up. So if anyone can think of a name for this party that's got for the disaffected voters that got nowhere to vote, then I would absolutely love to hear from you. Did you know there are many ways you can listen to TNT Radio? Why not stream us direct from our website on your desktop, tablet or mobile device, or download our app from the App Store? We even stream live on YouTube, Rumble and Odyssey. We've got you covered on TNT Radio.
Catch the news on the go.
I listen on the way to work.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has announced the proposed question Australians will be asked at this year's referendum and the draft constitutional amendment that would enable an indigenous voice to Parliament. TNT Radio news producer Jeremy Beck has details on this story. Jeremy.
Thanks. Thanks, Damien. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says the referendum working group has to decide the question that will be put forward to the Australian voters. A proposed law to alter the constitution to recognise the First Peoples of Australia by establishing an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice. Do you approve this proposed alteration? Now, in addition to this, Australians will be put a constitution question. And it will include a chapter titled Recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Peoples. The details would be, in recognition of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Peoples as the First Peoples of Australia. One, there shall be a body to be called the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Voice. Two, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Voice may make representations to the Parliament and the Executive Government of the Commonwealth on matters relating to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. Three, the Parliament shall, subject to this constitution, have the power to make laws with respect to matters relating to the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Voice, including its composition, functions, powers, and procedures. So that's it, Damien. Three simple points in there. I think one of the key points there is that word or two words, executive government, which is certainly quite a constitutional significant phrase there. Now, opposition leader Peter Dutton says the Liberal Party has not made the decision about whether to support the voice. But now we have some details. It's not quite firm. It's possible that wording could be changed, Damien.
So, would you think changes to the wording of the constitutional amendment will make much difference to the outcome of the referendum?
I don't think so, Damien. I think there are many people who are either going to be in the yes camp or the no camp. I'm not too sure that the wording will be highly convincing, really. I think it'd be more the emotional arguments and whether or not certain campaigns get significant funding or not to shift the public opinion one way or the other. I don't think the wording would be too significant. I think it'd be if there is a lot of emotional, advertising or something like that, it might get the yes vote going. I hope not, because I think people should realise what we're dealing with here. It's not helping Aboriginal people at all. It's actually quite divisive.
Well, if that's the case, who's this? If there is a constitutional change, who is it going to benefit?
I think it benefits the globalists, Damien. I see that the globalists have wanted this to take away our national sovereignty. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much what it comes down to. That's the broad summary of it, the globalist agenda, because they talk about First Nations people. Now, you talk to an expert in Aboriginal affairs, Josephine Cashman, and she says there were no such thing as First Nations people because they didn't have the concept of a nation. They were hunter-gatherers at the time. So we're talking the wrong language, and we should be talking about actually improving their lot, you know, giving them some decent jobs just along with all Australians and growing the economy to benefit us all rather than dividing us on racial lines.
Jeremy Beck, I think you've summed it up just perfectly. There's nothing for me to add on that. Jeremy, thanks so much for that news report. You're listening to TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Lynn Shaw.
So Houston, the government stepped in because failing grades. And they were also the government not happy with all of the programs for disabled kids. They were not up to par. Now, it's fair to say, pre-pandemic, pandemic, now, education system lacking behind. Easily, kids are at least a year behind. Now, here's the problem. This is mostly the majority house is Republican. So the Democrats are fighting, again, that weaponization, which does not belong in the school classrooms and all that. But what do you do when it's a failing school system? And of course, the ACLU, they stepped in and they're fighting because they want everybody to have freedom. The problem with Houston is, and this is what we really have to look at, and people are afraid to really go near this point, but I'm going to mention it. The public school system in Houston is 90% made up of children of color, Black, Hispanic. And why not be able, in my warrior's dream world, can you imagine school choice for these kids? Who could really, you know, flower in this environment?
Lynn Shaw on TNT Radio.
I'm Ben Affleck, and I want to thank you for joining me and supporting Paralyzed Veterans of America. Our vets need you.
I'm a quadriplegic. I'm definitely at risk with my diminished lung capacity.
I have MS. I'm in a wheelchair and I can't leave the house because I have a compromised immune system.
I'm very concerned about, would there be a bed for me? Would there be a ventilator for me? Would I be able to survive something?
It's just heavy. You know, it's a heavy moment.
This is a war. This really is.
Our veterans fought for us. Let's fight for them.
I am so grateful for the PVA. They're making sure that we have all of the food and supplies that we need right now.
We all gotta help each other right now. We can't get through this by ourselves.
It's with profound gratitude that you're gonna be saving our lives.
To find out how you can help, please go to helppva.org. That's helppva.org.
My neighbor is so excited. He just filled up his gas tank for $28. The bad news is it was his lawnmower.
I got the high.
This sucks.
The high gas prices blues.
Come on, man.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Was that just the actor Ben Affleck? I heard Ben Affleck voicing that ad for support for veterans. Does that mean it's okay now for actors to be on TNT radio? Ben, is everything going to be all right? I know Ben's probably looking at my career thinking, oh, if Damo can do it, yeah, I reckon I can do it as well. So you've led the way for Ben. I've just opened up a path for him. My first guest this hour is William Kinnamoth. William Kinnamoth has a career in meteorological science and policy spanning more than 40 years. For more than a decade, from 86 to 98, he headed Australia's National Climate Centre with responsibilities for monitoring Australia's changing climate and advising the Australian government on the extent and severity of climate extremes, including the recurring drought episodes of the 90s. He coordinated the scientific and technical review for the United Nations Task Force on El Nino following the disastrous 97-98 events. Has participated in WMO expert working groups. William Kinnamoth, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon, Damien.
Good to have you back. Now, what are we to make from this Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report that's just come out? And it says, I hope you're sitting down, it says only swift and dramatic action can avert irreconcilable damage to the world, irrevocable, I should say, damage to the world.
Well, Damien, I was wondering exactly which planet they're referring to, because I didn't recognise Earth very much in what they were talking about. What the IPCC does is it has a model climate, which has certain scenarios which emerge out of how they visualise Earth's processes to be. And it seems to be the whatever is happening, carbon dioxide is going to warm the Earth dangerously. Even if we stop putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, it will continue to warm, they say, because of their models. Now, this doesn't reflect what actually happens on Earth. We should recognise, of course, that over the last 40 years, the greatest warming has actually been in the Arctic, and it's actually been in wintertime. So it's the polar bears are not going to get sunstroke through global warming. So what has been happening over the last 40 years is that in those middle and high northern latitudes, the onset of the winter freezing has been delayed, and the spring thaw has arrived earlier. So there's been longer growing seasons. The planet has greened. We see this in the NASA satellite visualizations, and food production has increased. So it's quite different over the last 40 years of warming to what happened in the sort of the 17th century with the extreme cold, rivers freezing in Europe, and famine because of the low productivity of the land. So we're seeing over the last 40 years an increase in the biosphere response. Everything has been quite good for us. They talk about increasing extremes, but you can go almost anywhere in the world and look at bridges and so forth, where people mark flood levels, and you'll find floods at high levels going right back into the 16th century when some of those first European bridges were built. And also there's been droughts, go back to 1877, 1888, where millions of people in India and China died of famine because of an El Nino event. So El Nino and La Nina are the big climate extremes. They've been with us forever, and they'll continue with us forever. So I really don't see where the this doom and gloom is coming from, except the model scenarios that the IPCC comes up with, which really haven't been verified.
So are we to feel sorry then for these poor UN climate scientists that are just stuck with this horrible, terrible modelling, that they're a victim to the modelling, and they have no alternative to continue to find these doomsday results as a result of this modelling?
Well, I think that's right. And they set off on this path back in the early days of the IPCC. I recall the first report that came out, and there's a lot of doubt as to what was happening, as to whether carbon dioxide was really having a great effect. But as each report comes out, they've sort of doubled down. And by the third report in 2001, the doom and gloom were coming out. And the most recent one, even though the IPCC itself recognises that the models are in fact sort of going too hot, they still come up, the people who look at the scenarios take them without looking at some of the uncertainties behind them.
So we keep hearing these doomsday predictions.
Yes.
Greta Thunberg had a tweet that was 5 years ago. She tweeted that we've got 5 years to save the planet or face, you know, devastating consequences for humanity. So she deleted that tweet.
Well, I think that they recognise that all of these prescriptions of 5 and 10 years in advance, time goes on and where we live and we see those predictions haven't come out. And so they've got to withdraw them. There was somebody said that the dams of Australia would never fill again. Well, they're all overflowing.
Yes. So what do we do with that? That was our climate commissar under the Gillard government. But there's no reckoning for him, is there? Like there's no punishment for these false predictions that obviously can mean exorbitant power bills now for Australians?
This is the point, that the government is acting on these scenarios and the IPC saying we've got to decarbonise industry, and so the governments are following this recommendation, and there's no real alternative to fossil fuels at this stage, which is viable, which is cheap and reliable. And so we're getting wind and solar energy, but they're cutting out the power stations, the fossil fuel power stations, before enough of this wind and solar energy has been deployed. And even if it is, there's periods when there's no sunshine, there's no wind, and for hours and hours. And so you need some sort of a backup, and the batteries at this stage are not proven.
There was real pushback yesterday, I think it was, might have been the day before yesterday, in Ballarat, in regional Victoria, just out of Ballarat, a place called Dean. A lot of people, a lot of farmers and tractors, because they're just basically going to, AusNet is going to confiscate the land, put in the infrastructure for this green energy. So there is some pushback starting to occur, isn't there?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of hypocrisy too. I can recall about 25, 30 years ago, the Weather Bureau was wanting to put radar sites up on ridges so they get a very good view of the countryside around from the hilltop. And they were denied in most places because a radar sitting on a ridge isolated was going to be unsightly. And now we have all these windmills all along the ridges, which are apparently sightly. So it's hypocrisy.
So it's just bureaucracy justifying its own existence ultimately, because that's what bureaucracy will continue to do, won't it?
Well, they justify these what I call mad schemes that they come up with. The scenarios say a certain thing, so they've got to follow it, and then they sort of bring in justifications after the event. And there's no forward looking as to what is going to be the best for humanity in sort of 20 or 30 years' time. Now, if we talk about solar panels, the enormous area that's going to be occupied by solar panels to produce the energy that's going to be required, it's going to devastate the countryside. We are, at the present time, you can go out in the country and see there's sort of hundreds of acres of solar panels, which are just taking up good productive land.
Yeah. Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, said this report is a clarion call to massively fast-track climate efforts by every country and every sector and on every time frame. Our world needs climate action on all fronts, everything, everywhere, all at once.
But he's not saying this to China or India or Russia, who are expanding their fossil fuel capacity.
So I was being a bit disingenuous before when I said, you know, are these poor victims of the climate modelling? They're well aware of the arguments you're making now. They know full well of these arguments, but it's just not in their interests or interests of that institution to acknowledge that argument. So where's this stalemate lead to ultimately? Like I've heard some people's like mean there'll be some sort of civil conflict. Is that what you envisage, or is there some more moderate way to get out of this predicament?
It's hard to determine the future, but what's happening is that we're heading down the path of poverty, whereas China and India and so forth, they're developing and bringing sort of good fortune to their people because they're industrializing. And good on them for doing that, because their standards of living have been fairly low. You know, I've been to India and it's not as good as Australia. But the evening out is by bringing our standard of living down to allow them to come up, because they're going to continue to use our coal and our gas to power their industries.
So do we have a moral responsibility to allow this to happen? Is that what's being suggested?
No, what I'm suggesting is that we're going along the wrong path in the taking carbon out of our industry, because it's the baseload of what has got us. Now, carbon is not a renewable energy source, so at some stage in the future, we're going to have to go somewhere else. Now, our long-term planning is to, do we want to go in the future forever as wind and solar, or do we go some other way, such as nuclear? And nuclear means small power stations. You've got concentrated energy in the uranium and other nuclear fuels that you don't need enormous areas, don't need enormous factories. You can generate the electricity that you need in a very small space, as against the wind and solar, which, you know, take up enormous space to generate it and capture it.
Okay, then you got to store the waste. We'll come back and we'll talk about that. Are we just going to a quick break? You're listening to TNT Radio.
Time to read some news. TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan here with a look at your TNT headlines. Chinese President Xi Jinping has wrapped up his three-day state visit to Russia after signing over a dozen bilateral agreements with Moscow. Protesters have taken to the streets of Paris for the sixth night in a row as anger grows over the president's controversial pension reforms, and there are fresh warnings that the banking crisis could swallow up another 50 regional lenders in the US if appropriate steps are not taken to resolve structural issues.
We're the pinup boys and poster girls for free speech. We just don't look as impressive as Vladimir Putin shirtless on a horse. Yeah. 24/7, 365. We never stop sifting fact from fiction, misinformation from the truth. From government overreach to the latest on mandates, big tech censorship to propaganda gone mad. Listen to TNT Radio and get the news and views direct from our expert presenters and commentators anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
So, William, I was interested, you were saying like that there is an issue ultimately with carbon that will need to be addressed at some stage.
Oh, indeed, yes. You know, people talk about 100 years supply of coal in the ground or 200 years, but we all know, of course, that the gas fields, each one as that's developed, it then expires. You know, the Bass Strait is not much is coming out of that anymore. So in the future, we're going to have to look for another energy source. And,
You just mean the source of our energy is what's going to stop us, not the fact that there's so much carbon in the atmosphere that's a problem.
No. It's just they talk about 100 years. Well, what's 100 years in history? Eventually, and it's going to take a long time to change from a fossil fuel-based energy source to some other form. We're rushing through at the present time with the supposed decarbonisation with wind and solar, but we're failing and we will continue to fail. They're not going to make that 2030 or 2050 timeline, because it just to put the amount of wind and solar in is just not possible. You know, many experts have said this.
It's politically very difficult for any government. You can see that quite clearly. We've had a two mines policy since the Hawke-Keating government back in the 80s, as far as uranium is concerned. Do you think it's an opportunity, because we're about to get those nuclear subs? It'd be perfect timing in a way for a government to be able to say, well, you know, come on, we need to be able to power these subs for, you know, just our autonomy, the autonomy of our military itself, as a means to say we should develop some technology in that area, nuclear technology?
Well, if you're going to have nuclear submarines, you'll need experts to run those submarines. Yeah. And you can't just train people for submarines. If you've got a land-based nuclear energy basis, you can have people going from one to the other, and you've got a large pool of expertise. Whereas if you've just got the submarines, you've only got a very small pool of expertise, and it's very hard to maintain that.
So it is potentially a really great opportunity there. It's just staring us in the face, isn't it? What is it about Australia? We can't grasp that opportunity.
Well, there's been the traditional fear of uranium being used as a fuel for atomic weapons. But I think that a lot of the modern power sources don't use weapons-grade uranium. Then, of course, there's the fear of the waste. But I think other countries are solving that. And we've a number of our governments have said there is space in Western Australia and South Australia to actually store some of these waste deep underground. So that's not
it lasts for thousands of years, though, doesn't it? Those isotopes last as waste for thousands of years, don't they?
Indeed, but you know where you've put them, and you're not going to dig around there. So it's somewhere where you haven't got you make sure there's no gold or coal copper resources down there, and you find a bit of dirt that's got nothing in it, and you dig down and put it in.
And South Australia and Western Australia, as you say, Australia in the middle there particularly, is a very geographically secure.
Yes, they're stable, yes.
Although I believe there was an earthquake in South Australia today, we might put paid to that. It was 4.8, I think, on the Richter scale, emanating from the Flinders Ranges.
Yeah, well, you can go further north of the Flinders Ranges, and it's pretty stable, yes. Yeah, there's earthquakes everywhere. We had an earthquake in Melbourne just not that long ago, and it shook the buildings a bit. So, there's earthquakes is something you've got to look out for and design for, but it's not impossible.
But who's going to do it? No one's going to do it. We've seen Liberal trying to shadow Labor on every social policy. There's no way that's going to be, although they say they are looking into the efficacy or viability of nuclear power, but there's no chance of them finding the political will, is there, especially as they've got this problem now with the Teals cannibalising their vote?
Well, no, eventually, and when I say eventually, maybe in a decade or so, the cost of power will be so great and the unreliability of the power will be such that the governments will be looking for something else, and all the political parties will suddenly realise, well, look, we were going down the wrong burrow. We've got to reassess what we're doing in the future.
So that will suddenly become a race to be the first to do it as opposed to no one doing it. The uni party will move slowly towards, and suddenly they'll both be running towards the same goal.
It'd be better if they had sort of both parties came together and jointly said, okay, we agree, this is the way forward for the future.
I think they're going about climate so much. Yes. Well, they seem to be finding
bipartisanship
on so many other things.
Yeah, certainly on the nuclear submarines they're doing it, so why not nuclear on the land?
Yeah, and so I'll ask you this then, is this whole climate thing, which is seems to be a bit of a sham in many respects, emanating from globalist non-government organisations like the United Nations, the WEF, the WHO, et cetera, do you think there's some argument to be made for Australia actually pulling out of the United Nations?
I don't think that's necessary. All they've got to do is say, look, some of these things that you don't have to agree to everything that is put up. And this is the problem with the IPCC, is that you have a finding at the end of the day, which all the countries, all the governments agree to. And so when the IPCC makes a report, in fact, it's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, not international, intergovernmental. So our government sends representatives on our behalf, and they agree to whatever comes out. And so the government has essentially got to agree to it. So the next IPCC report, maybe the government should send along some representatives who say, look, no, that's not the way Australia wants to go. This is what we're going to do.
But Australia gets international finance, doesn't it, from foreign banks. So our hands are tied, aren't they? We can't afford to say to foreign banks which are using ESG, environmental social governance, which is about green energy ultimately and things like that, oh, we're not going to do what the UN says. We're in a bind, aren't we, ultimately?
Well, eventually you've got to stand up for your principles, and you can't be bowed by these sort of non-elected people in the UN. We've got to say, this is what we want. Now, it might hurt us a little bit, but we've got to stand up for our principles. China, of course, it doesn't care about what the UN says. It's going ahead putting in coal-fired power stations and everything, so is India and Russia. So why can they do it and we not?
Is it because they just have far bigger population bases and we're a minnow on the world stage?
Well, we don't have a lot of power stations. We can just have a few. We have for a small population, but we have a lot of industry which is dependent on energy. And if we sort of sacrifice that low-cost energy, we're going to go into poverty anyway.
So nuclear would be the real thing, wouldn't it? Because then we could say, yeah, look, UN, hey, we're actually exceeding a reduction in our carbon emissions, and let's go, bring it on.
We're doing what other countries are doing, yes. Yeah, Europe has got nuclear, so why shouldn't Australia?
Yeah, I always find that strange because I find the sort of people that really don't like nuclear, you love to holiday in France quite often. And, you know, they've had, I think, something like 70% of their power from nuclear for decades now.
That's right. Yes. And I lived very close to a nuclear power station for a number of years, off and on. And all you saw was like a building that looked like a factory.
How many fingers have you got, William?
I've got 10 and 10 toes.
And then there's not an 11th one trying to bust through?
No. I've lived for 80 years, so I'm okay.
You're going okay. William Kinnamoth, thanks so much for joining me on the Damien Richardson Show.
You're welcome, Damien.
Good on you, mate. You're listening to TNT Radio.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Oh, how sweet it is. The great one Jackie Gleason's favorite tagline is ever so appropriate to describe Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg's plight after it came to light that he withheld over 600 pages of exculpatory evidence from the Manhattan grand jury impaneled to indict President Donald Trump. Withholding exculpatory evidence is a serious breach of legal ethics. I predicted that this political persecution, which was declined by the Federal Election Commission, by the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, by the New York State Attorney General, would come back to bite Alvin in the arse. And sure enough, it looks like it might lead to his disbarment. And away we go. From MAGAinstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Big tech companies are notorious for censoring inconvenient views. Any search for a contested topic online, Google and other search engines almost invariably rank the most politically correct views higher. Social media giants will de-platform anyone upsetting the globalists' agenda, even if they are the US president. Big tech employs so-called fact-checkers who attempt to discredit highly qualified experts not towing the establishment line. But when government officials make indisputable errors, the fact-checkers are nowhere in sight. The London-based fact-checking organisation Full Fact has worked with big tech giants including Facebook, Google and Twitter. Full Fact's head of communications, Ross Haig, was formerly head of communications of the Behavioural Insights team, the notorious Nudge Unit, which employ psychological techniques to manipulate public behaviours and attitudes.
Plug in.
Website?
TNTradio.live.
Check it out.
Today's News Talk Radio.
It's the coolest.
TNT.
Now, my second guest this hour is a show favourite. It's Omar Khan. He's a global consultant who has advised clients worldwide on leadership responses to opportunities and crisis. Crisis often leads to opportunity, I hear. His firm, EPL Global, seeks to convey better information for better decision-making. Omar Khan, welcome back to the show. Omar Khan has dropped out of the show. It's disappointing. I give him a big rap and suddenly he says, no, he's not coming on at all. It's interesting because he wrote an article in the Daily Financial Times, which is another really good article, and it's excoriating in its understanding now, if we've got a little bit of time, from what happened throughout the COVID panic. And he writes from a particular point of view with how it actually affected Sri Lanka and Sri Lankans, which has a correlates, of course, to how it affected all of us, but it's specific to Sri Lanka. But he does quote someone right at the start of the article that I wanted to talk about. I was going to say it to him, and it's William Derezowitz, and the quote is, "Moral courage can be lonely. Indeed, people don't mind being trapped as long as no one else is free. But stage a break and everybody else begins to panic." And it reminded me of a conversation I know I was talking about on the show yesterday, but it's worth repeating. I had yesterday with a pilot, and I've heard this so often from pilots, and I was talking to this guy too, and he said, you know, the thing about being a pilot is they'll do anything because it's just an addiction to flying. It's one of those careers. And I can understand that, because there's certainly something about that in performance too, when you're an actor and you're performing and it's all going and it's really working for you. There's an adrenaline rush that you get from it. It's like a drug. And clearly that's the case for pilots too. And I hadn't really thought about it because I've never been a pilot myself, but I thought, I think he's right. So he's saying, I could see how he's saying it's a big, you know, it's a difficult thing to say, okay, I'm not going to do that anymore. But he looked like he was going to get another chance. He'd been sacked from one organisation, and to protect his anonymity at this point in time, I'm hoping he'll come on the show. I won't say who he is, but he went to another organisation, and he looked like he was going to get his flying licence again, and he had to retrain to be in accord with the protocols that this other organisation have, because each plane, as you can imagine, is specific and different in its capabilities and what you need to know. And when the person who was championing him left that organisation, there was other people there that didn't like him. That didn't like him because he had broken free from the COVID narrative, and they felt they hadn't been given that option. They felt, no, I had to take this medication, and I never wanted to take it either. And there's no way I'm sitting next to you in co-captains flying an aeroplane. And he was summarily dismissed. And now I have the opportunity to talk to my guest about that, which is Omar Khan. I've already introduced you, Omar, so I'm just going to say, g'day. Are you there, Omar?
Good. Well, in Sri Lanka, the IMF came through with emergency funding that had been petitioned for a long time, and everyone thought, if you remember last June, last May, that Sri Lanka was going to be a failed state.
Insolvent, yes.
Insolvent, and, you know, they ran these crazy, ghoulish videos of a country coming apart at the seams, though it really looked to me like a bad weekend in Chicago, rather than anything existential.
Which could be the same thing, anyway, any other country that would be coming apart by the seams. But anyway, yes.
Right, but for Chicago, it just takes it in its stride, do many other places, Rio, parts, you know, Joburg, other places. But anyway, yesterday it came through, so it's an interesting milestone for the country. This is the 17th time they've gone to the IMF, this time, but as a nation that had defaulted, which is what made it difficult, but that has put fresh vitality into the system here.
Okay, and what payback does it come with? I mean, that money's not coming for free. What's the cost?
No, it's not, but they'll get a moratorium for a while. All the donors have restructured the debts. They'll have an opportunity, therefore, to vastly reduce the cost of government, which needs to happen, to remove to privatize state-owned enterprises, which, again, has been a long time coming, the top insurance companies and some of the others, and allow that capital and that sort of market focus to come in and redeem it. You have to understand the 80 cents out of the budget here of every dollar spent goes to funding the government currently. Okay. And 80% goes to funding an ineffective government, So that's, I mean, if that comes down, say, to maybe 30% or 40%, that by itself, I mean, because it's otherwise it's a smart country, human capital is good, is geopolitically well-placed, nobody wants it to fail. So I think this is just a chance for an intelligent reset, not the great reset.
Okay, so you're quite hopeful then. You're quite hopeful. You sound quite hopeful. I read your article, and this is obviously your article was written before this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the article is just arguing that the devil is in the detail, right? I mean, the Courage and Coherence article that you saw, you know, which talked about the rabid failure of courage globally, not just in Sri Lanka, ostracizing anybody who has spoken up, vilifying them, attacking them, disdaining what they had to say. And I've suggested that something like the framework that had been developed in Harvard and MIT called Theory U, which creates impact labs, a way to structure dialogue, is needed. I mean, so if you take any country, you might say they need to improve their economics, they need to improve their education system, they need to improve living together in terms of dispersal of wealth and how the least well-off are handled, and they need something in terms of infrastructure and civic rehab. Now, we all know that, but converting intention into action, that's the difference that makes the difference. And a lot of countries that don't give big speeches but do that well, like Japan, South Korea, Vietnam, have prospered at a pace that others can, you know, just look at and gasp in awe. On the other hand, some of those societies don't have, until recently, we thought, the liberal values that we were proud of, but of course we've lost those as well, without necessarily having picked up any execution capability.
What stopped Sri Lanka historically then from enjoying that prosperity that you talk about, those other countries like South Korea, et cetera? Is that the political instability with the Tamils wanting their separate state, et cetera?
That came in at some point, but I think it was primarily the choking bureaucracy. And the whole subcontinent has had it. I mean, India almost went bankrupt and before they re-energized themselves into a market-friendly environment, which they've certainly now become. They're open for business. Sri Lanka was the most prosperous nation in the region, other than Japan, in the 50s. They're the only other country that produced automobiles for export, for example. But it just shows you how quickly things can disappear, or on the other hand, a malarial swamp called Singapore, with the right leadership, putting in accountability and metrics and public service, keeping the cost of government to a minimum, making sure there's a unifying language like English. Lee Kuan Yew didn't allow, for example, either one of the Chinese languages, Mandarin or Cantonese, or Malay to become the language of the country. And when here in Sri Lanka they decided that Sinhalese was going to be the official language, that's what began to alienate the Tamils. It also began to alienate other pockets of the population, some of the Muslim community and so on. But on the other hand, look, I mean, it's a country that is not extreme or radical. It doesn't have the problems of a Pakistan. It doesn't have the teeming poverty of a Bangladesh. It's of manageable size. So they are their own worst enemies. It's a congenial place. So I'm hopeful that having been that close to the precipice, and there, but for the grace of God, they went. And the youth have just, I think, you know, they've had it. And I'm hoping the youth globally have had it. I mean, I know that one of the things you've been looking at, I think your colleagues sent me the link, is this wonderful thing written by Margaret Anna Alice, right?
Yes, I saw that. Yeah, it's extraordinary.
Mistakes were not made, an anthem for justice. My friend Tess Laurie read with such aplomb and such feeling. Yeah. Have you gotten good reaction to that? Has that been circulated at your end?
I haven't seen much of its circulation, but I had a look at it just before I talked to you, and it's made, yeah, and she basically cites those great genocides, the Armenian genocide, the Holodomor, obviously the Final Solution, the Great Leap Forward in China, and she basically says that this is the same thing. Is that what you think as well?
I think what she's saying response? Is that none of these things were a mistake. People were complicit with their eyes open. And I think she's saying this was not a job of, you know, good faith botching. These were, she calls them the philanthropaths bought the science. So philanthropic psychopaths, modelers projected the lies, but they were paid to do it. And there's a wonderful word she uses, and I'm just wondering if some of your listeners might enjoy looking at that word. And she says at some point, she talks about menticide.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, I think a lot of folks don't realize what menticide is, but it is the committing of suicide by not using your mental faculties. I mean, it is mental suicide, in other words. And that's what she thinks to some extent happened. You know, she says the menticiders scripted, the bamboozled bleated, the totalitarianized bullied, the COVIDians tattled, the parents surrendered and good citizens believed and forgot. But voluntary committing, I think my next article is actually going to be called Menticide.
Okay. And was this done deliberately, though, or was it just people saw the opportunity, they knew which way the bread was buttered, and they just went along to get along?
I think a lot of agendas, I think you and I were talking about this last week, there was a desire to cool down demand, to be able to deal with all of the money that was suddenly being called upon. There was this desire to do a test run on shutting society down and centralizing the health response. There was a desire to perhaps make a bid for government as, you know, the savior and maybe the source of... So there were a lot of agendas that I think were there that opportunistically, you know, jumped on this. But that was not a mistake. I mean, it was done with complete knowledge, forethought. I mean, they knew when they decided to suppress the VAERS, for example, and I know you've been following that story as well, when the CDC decided to stop advertising what the adverse effects of the government database was reporting, it just meant they didn't care, right? I mean, it didn't matter how many people were dying as long as you couldn't prove it.
Well, they knew they were safe from criminal prosecution. They knew they were safe from criminal prosecution, didn't they? In your article, your latest article, you cite Kafka's trial and the inability to deal with the bureaucracy, and then Kafka doesn't know what's going on, or his protagonist in that novel doesn't know what's going on. He finally finds out. Yeah, he finds out that he's on trial for the bureaucracy, but he knows not what he's been accused of.
Yeah, or even where to present himself, or what it's about. And I think that's what happens here, right? I mean, people suddenly find, I mean, there are horrible, horrible tales of things that were done that, you know, when you look at them, you know, you say to yourself, how can I call this a mistake? And how does deplatforming... how can you possibly just call that a mistake? If you were genuinely thinking you were at risk, then you would want to hear from everybody, wouldn't you? I mean, the Michael Yaden, of course, and others believe that this virus never really existed, that it was cobbled together from different influenza strains, different normal coronavirus. And, you know, everywhere there was smoke, COVID was the fire, allegedly.
And that's the thing with the Kafka's trial, isn't it? He's on trial for just existing, ultimately. He's in breach of, who knows? He's just in breach for his prior presence alone. And that's frightening for people, isn't it, too? You talk about the COVID, because they didn't know where to turn. So ultimately, they turned
in fear. Well, I mean, here's a list. Right. Exactly. They turned in fear and just said, just shut up. So, you know, they've been having the trial of Boris for Partygate, sort of, you think, for all the things he did. I mean,
Johnson,
you know, what about all the children that never got back to school? 140,000 kids. I mean, nobody's ever going to talk about that. Here's a list of things, by the way, that did happen. A woman handcuffed in the UK for queuing for a coffee shop. A young woman fined £2,000 for visiting a home to support a friend who had fled an abusive relationship. A man fined for having driven too far to go fishing.
Yep.
Pensioners fined for eating a bag of chips in a laundrette. When you have lost the plot to that extent, that's the part I think that was unplanned, when it just spun out of control, where everybody wanted to just join the club. But these were not genuine mistakes. These were callous, thought-out ways to remove civil liberties and to undermine the fabric of a society. And that's why we must not consider them, honest mistakes. So that when they come around the second time, they're told, hell no.
Omar, thanks so much for joining us. We've got to go to a news break.